Today, after a catastrophic blast in Beirut, Lebanon's government falls. Just a heads up to listeners, this podcast contains some strong language. Today marks 1 week since 3,000 tons of ammonium nitrate exploded in the port of Beirut, killing dozens of people and leaving the city in ruins. Over the weekend, protesters took to the streets, chanting, "They must go," and taking over ministry headquarters. Then, on Monday, the Lebanese government fell.
The Prime Minister, Hassan Diab, is expected to stand down shortly. The rest of his government has already resigned following...
But angry residents still want to know why that ammonium nitrate, which had been piled up in warehouses in the port since 2013, was being held there in the first place. From The Guardian, I'm Mythili Rao. Today in Focus, as the government falls in Beirut, will anything change?
Was a typical Beirut afternoon, as typical as things get these days. Rather dystopian feel on the streets.
Martin Chulov is The Guardian's Middle East correspondent. He's called Beirut home for nearly 15 years.
Traffic jams, shops that are empty, the midsummer heat, and an overwhelming despair which has descended on Beirut over the summer as the economic implosion had settled in. We were just preparing for an evening meal, an early evening meal. Next thing you know, the building shook. Extremely violently, a very short little shudder. And then... this overwhelming crush of force just rushed right through the house, shattering all our windows inside. And I think I remember being frozen in fear as these glass pieces just flew through the flat. There was a deathly silence both inside the house and outside. And then we heard this shattering of glass just coming from all directions. It was a cascade as the glass fell out of our building and the buildings all around. Then followed by car alarms and screaming. My initial thoughts were that this has to be a bomb. So after I gathered my senses, I went to get my daughter, who was in her room. She's 9 years old. She was understandably very shaken and screaming. I took her out into the hallway, hugged her close and calmed her down and told her there's no windows near us now and nothing else can blow us up. So you'll be okay here. Just sit down here. So once I was sure that she was calmed down and she was looking me in the eyes and saying, "I'm okay, Daddy, I'll be fine," and I could leave her in the house with some other people, I had to do my job, and the job is to find out what happened. I ran down the stairs of the building, down the staircase. There was debris all around, and got out into the streets and walked further down the road to see what I could find.
And when you stepped out into the street, what did you see?
It was a catastrophic streetscape of jagged glass which had blown through car roofs. There were trees down. There was masonry and all sorts of debris which was across our road. And as I walked down the road, which leads down to the Jumeizah district, so Jumeizah was one of the hardest hit districts in Beirut, and it's just adjoining the port. The further I got, the more intensive the damage was. It didn't take long before I stumbled across a pool of blood, a very large pool of blood. And further down the road, there were blood trails everywhere. There were dead and dying, lots of people bleeding, pandemonium, car horns, crying and screaming. Some people just walking up the middle of the road, blackened. Looking right, there was an enormous mushroom cloud, which had started to dissipate by that point, but it was just clearly over the port area. So it was very clear to me that the port had blown up. And at that point, my thoughts changed from, was this a car bomb, to could this have been an attack? Because the port in Beirut is one of the most strategic sites in the country. That was the initial thinking, and it remained that way for several hours until sometime in the mid-evening that the first suggestions that this was in fact ammonium nitrate that had been stored in a warehouse started to be confirmed.
The way you describe the explosion, it sounds like it, you know, it felt like it was very close. You thought it was a car bomb, but you were 2 kilometers away. Can you give us a sense of the scale of the destruction across Beirut?
Well, in East Beirut, where I am, I don't think there's a building between here and the port, and maybe even up to 500 to 800 meters behind me, so heading further south, that would not have been damaged in some way by this blast. And as I walked all around the eastern suburbs that evening and down towards the Jamaisi district and Mam Khail, which was almost directly in front of the port itself, every single building I encountered was severely damaged. No glass. The interiors had been utterly vacuumed out and destroyed. At nighttime, with a pail of haze and smoke and dust still hanging over it, it looked utterly apocalyptic. All of the sites that we'd been familiar with for so many years in Beirut, the cafes, the bars, the coffee shops, which we all knew, and their proprietors, had been blown up. There was an Irish co-owner of one of the cafes here called Alia's. Her name is Neem Fleming Farrell. She'd been blown across the room of her bar, and I walked past it and looked into it and thought, I don't know how people survive there. Further up the road, a restaurant which had been in existence for 45 years and for most of that time run by a friend of mine called Shabul Basil, that was also destroyed, and I wondered what happened to him, and made notes to call my friends the following morning. But there wasn't a building that wasn't damaged, and many of them had severe structural damage that will take a long, long time to be repaired, if they can be repaired at all.
Bethan McKernan, you are a Middle East correspondent for The Guardian, currently based in Istanbul, but you used to live in Beirut. When you returned there last week, what did you find when you arrived?
Well, normally when you're flying into Beirut, when you're looking out of the window of the plane, you do see the port first. It's kind of a very obvious landmark. When I flew in on Wednesday nights, the port was sort of ablaze with light, lots of floodlights illuminating the work that the rescue teams and the excavators were doing and still trying to make sure that the area was safe. And then the two neighbourhoods directly behind the port are Mam Khail and Jamaisi and Ashrafieh, and all of them were in pitch blackness, which was very eerie to look at. But it was very obvious that something really terrible had happened in that area that I used to call home.
Did you go back to your old neighbourhood? What did you see?
I went to visit the first apartment that I lived in, and the window of my bedroom used to look out towards the port. It was only about 900 metres away, and the whole apartment was completely devastated. You know, the furniture was broken. It had been flung across the room. Every single window in the place was broken, and the building itself is quite old. It doesn't look like it's that structurally safe anymore, and when I tried to go in and had a quick look, a cleanup team that was there trying to help my neighbours said, actually, we think we're just going to have to get everybody out because it doesn't look safe. I don't know how this blast didn't kill more people. Honestly, it's a miracle. If a shard of glass sort of hit you in the wrong place in an artery or something, you know, you would have been dead in minutes. And somehow lots and lots of people have these really lucky stories of escape. But it's just staggering, the level of damage.
As we record this, the death toll is now over 200. Dozens of people are still missing, and there are 6,000 people who have been seriously injured. 3 of Beirut's hospitals were completely destroyed. Did you manage to visit any of the hospitals in the city?
Yes. The second apartment I lived in Beirut was right next door to one of the major private hospitals in East Beirut called Mustashfa al-Rum, or St. George to the French-speaking community. And it's a wreck.
It was truly chaos everywhere. the hospital was full of patients and it became completely non-functional. So we had to evacuate all the patients to the ground floor, or actually to the ER floor, and to outside of the ER. We didn't have any electricity. We had patients who had arrests in the parking lot of the ER, and emergency doctors were rushing to them, trying to intubate, and we were doing cycles of arrests on the patients in the parking lot. It was truly a very, very traumatic experience. A doctor, anyone who chooses the profession of a doctor already knows that there's a lot of sacrifice to be done. There's a lot of risking of our lives to save the lives of others. But I don't think that anyone would have signed up for what we lived yesterday in Beirut.
It looked like a bomb had gone off inside the hospital or next to the hospital, not somewhere that was, you know, 1.5 kilometers away. There were hospital beds on their sides, medicine cabinets, pills and glass just everywhere, all over the floor, you know, completely unusable. You could pick every single pill up, but you wouldn't know what it was. So all of that's been wasted. Bloodstocks going bad in the heat. It was, it looked like a zombie movie. Honestly, it looked like that bit in 28 Days Later where he wakes up and there's just nobody there. And it's very obvious that something very bad has happened.
That's horrific to hear. And I imagine many of those doctors and nurses may not know if they can go back to their homes. How many people have been displaced from their homes?
I don't think we're going to know the exact number for a while. And honestly, like most things Lebanon, the numbers that come from officials are never particularly trustworthy anyway. But the president said that 300,000 people are now homeless as a result of this accident. I wonder if that total might actually be a bit higher, because there are very working class districts to the east of the port, beyond, you know, the Christian middle class districts that got hit very hard. There are some working class neighborhoods sort of a bit further east, which are home to a lot of migrant workers from South Asia, to a lot of Syrians. And a lot of those people are undocumented and, you know, will often live a couple of people to a flat or even a couple of people to a room. And they're not the communities that have people highlighting their cases.
Just a week ago, we had Martin Chulov on the podcast, and he was telling us about Lebanon's economic crisis. And with this collapsed financial system, what are people doing to clean up and repair the city?
Well, I mean, the Lebanese were already pretty desperate and extremely angry with their government last year as a result of the financial and economic crisis. Last week's explosion happened, and now what we're looking at are people who had already lost the majority of their savings, and their homes were probably the one thing that they did have left, and now that's gone too. So there's nobody here who's got the money to pay to rebuild anything. I went to visit a glassmaker in the south of Beirut, and he told me that the cheapest you can repair a normal size window for is about $8, but he was only going to accept payment from people in US dollars rather than in Lebanese lira, because obviously the lira is not worth anything anymore, and nobody's got dollars to actually pay that. And on top of that, Lebanon imports almost everything through this port. So this glassmaker said, I import all of my stock from places like Germany and Saudi Arabia. So once I sell what I have in this warehouse, that's it. You know, there won't be any glass for people to rebuild, even if they had the money, even if they wanted to. So it's sort of going to be a double problem.
There's an investigation underway to identify what happened, who is accountable. What stage is that at now? And have any arrests been made?
We still don't know exactly what caused the initial fire. People at the port knew that fireworks were being stored in the vicinity of this stash of ammonium nitrate, and several people were worried about it and raised concerns about it. But it's abundantly clear at this point that, you know, the incompetence and the malfeasance of the Lebanese state contributed to creating the conditions in which something like this was even possible. The Lebanese president is a man called Michel Aoun, and he promised that there would be a preliminary investigation that would publish its results on Sunday. And, you know, classic Lebanese state. We've not heard anything from him further on that matter. That's not surprising at all. So far, there have been 16 house arrests of people who worked at the port. We're not entirely clear, you know, what role each of those people played in this disaster yet. And there's a lot of worry here that any kind of Lebanese investigation won't actually get to the truth. Aoun, the president, has promised that no one in government, no matter how well-connected or how high up they are, will be exempt from an investigation. But, you know, in the same breath, he's also kind of insinuated that maybe it wasn't an explosion, maybe it was foreign interference. You know, he's basically saying maybe it was an Israeli bomb, which has been pretty comprehensively debunked at this point. But the fact that he's even saying that suggests, you know, he's laying the groundwork for there to be wiggle room for the political elite to shift the blame, which is honestly pretty much the only thing that they're good at doing.
At the same time that this investigation is underway, there have been a series of protests. You attended some of those. What did you see?
After the explosion, people were still a bit too shell-shocked to go out and protest, and they were busy with the cleanup effort. But by Saturday, there were tens of thousands of people flooding Martyrs Square in the centre of town. That's basically adjacent to where the blast hit hardest. There were lots of sort of families with young kids and older people. But it got very angry and quite violent very quickly. The chants that people were using were new. Some of them are not actually fit to be heard on a podcast because they're pretty explicit. But you know, the mood had definitely changed.
I will talk. I will not accept that the investigation doesn't go to the full truth. This is my commitment as Minister of Justice.
But the people don't trust you.
The people don't trust. I understand the people because the people are fed up. The people are suffering. I understand the people.
People are absolutely furious with the Minister of Justice. They won't let her walk along the street. She may say that there's going to be an investigation, but people have no trust. They have no belief in this government. She's quite brave, actually, to come out here on this street and face the people. But they don't care about that. They just want this government gone.
And then they shout, "Thawra, Thawra, revolution." As she continues her tour of the damaged neighbourhood of Jemaisi, they throw water bottles to show their anger.
You know, before people were out protesting and saying all of them means all of them, they all have to go. Now they're saying, you know, all of them means all of them, and they're also carrying nooses, right? There are lots of people who want justice, and quite a few people said, you know, we want revenge.
Hi, you guys. I'm a journalist from The Guardian in London. I wanted to know if I could talk to you about why you're in Martyrs Square today.
There's nothing different. It's the same thing. On and on and on. We can't breathe anymore. We can't endure this shit anymore. It's the same thing. We can't endure this. I don't know. I don't have the word to express my anger, my feelings. I don't know.
I know. It's horrendous.
I just can't tell you that we can't endure this shit anymore.
Coming up, the fall of the Lebanese government. Martin, shortly after we spoke to Bethan on Monday, the entire cabinet announced that it would resign, and the prime minister said that he would step down too. This seems like quite an incredible development and a real response to what protesters were demanding out on the streets. But what does the fall of the government really mean?
It's certainly the first step. It's been a core demand of demonstrators that have taken to the streets of Martyrs Square in central Beirut and the silent majority who are still cleaning up the catastrophe that befell them. But is it going to change anything? That is the core question that is being asked. And at this point, it seems that the following will happen. The government resigns, it becomes a caretaker administration. In other words, the same ministers who have quit their posts are going to be re-empowered with running the country until an alternative emerges. Now, in the past, Lebanon has been run by caretaker governments for many months and sometimes upwards of a year. Do they have that time? Do they have that liberty at this point? I wouldn't have thought so, but there is going to be a lot of haggling going on over who emerges in the wake of those who have just left their post. At the end of the day, though, does this really solve the structural problems that have got Lebanon to where they are? And that is this entrenched system of patronage networks, which are accountable to warlords and feudal lords who are part of the political process, but also above and beyond it. A country that is officially bankrupt, it can't honour its debts to the international community, it can't service its obligations to locals, the currency has plunged by more than 80%, unemployment is up by 70%, there's a huge underclass now, and the middle classes are blending into the underclass. There are people who simply can't make ends meet and had been able to ride through prior crises, but nothing before has been as existential as what Lebanon is going through now. And its leaders, its politicians, are quite rightly being blamed for the diabolical mess that we're in. Some people in Lebanon are looking for a complete clean out of the parliament, and that would be parliamentary elections, which could possibly inject new faces and new voices who are prepared to take on the old guard and their vested interests. If that were to happen, it may well instill more confidence in the political process here, which is at absolute rock bottom now. But this seems to be a reckoning, a moment of reckoning for the entire country. If there cannot be some form of transparency or accountability, and we're talking real accountability here, finding out how this happened, who ordered it, and who's been giving cover to hold 3,000 tonnes of ammonium nitrate on the edge of the largest residential districts in the city for the last 6 years, and why.
It's sort of amazing, as someone who's never visited Beirut, to read these accounts and think this is all being described as like a bureaucratic blunder. Given your experience living in Beirut for so long and seeing that corruption and dysfunctional government up close, does that explanation make sense to you?
Oh, it's far more than blundering bureaucracy here. There are stakeholders in this country who had an interest in keeping that ammonium nitrate in those warehouses, and that's very clear. That simply could not happen without top political cover. We're talking tier one, and there would be ministers at all levels who would have been involved in the, at the very least, in the torpor, not taking a decision about what to do with it. But there would have been others who would have considered it valuable to keep it there. And why that is needs to be answered.
Martin, I don't want to be sentimental, but people always say that disasters bring people together and they bring out the best in people and they kind of bring out even a community energy and spirit. Are you seeing any of that in Beirut right now?
Yeah, there certainly is a community spirit. The cleanup has been very impressive. Given the scale of the damage, seeing what's been achieved in the days since has been surprising and refreshing. Lots of the glass which had covered the streets like the aftermath of a winter blizzard has been swept into piles. People have been going through buildings, helping the neighbours just pull masonry out and just get some semblance of normalcy up again so you can reassemble a bed or put some sheets down on a floor or something like that. We've seen people from way outside of East Beirut turning up with brooms and shovels and wheelbarrows and water. And just people walking around town asking, does anyone need anything? And I think it is giving people hope in times of such anguish and tumult.
Martin, it's been such an eventful series of days in Lebanon. First, that tragic blast. Then, after dramatic protests, the government resigning. Even if, as you said, that's just one small step towards change in the country. How are you feeling about everything, both as a journalist and as a resident of Beirut?
As a resident of Beirut, I'm impressed by what I've seen in the community spirit that is stirred and mobilized, and it's refreshing and it's decent and it's affirming. And but as somebody who's seen this country disintegrate over so many years now, and to see it get to this point, if there is not a genuine seismic shift in how this country is governed, and an end to the impunity that has got us to where we are, then I would struggle to see a future for a place that has been a home to me now for the best part of 15 years. And that would be very upsetting. I mean, yesterday I sat down with a lot of my friends who are deeply committed. They're patriots. They've invested a lot in the cause of the uprising from last year and really do want to see this country do well. And for the first time, they were initiating discussions with me about leaving the country. And that to them was almost shameful, because it was taboo until this point to consider giving up. And I was just making the point to them that it's not giving up. It's just a life decision. It's a decision you're taking to leave is to live. And if that's a decision you've made after going through so much, then that decision is yours. And it's certainly totally understandable. So, look, a moment of absolute reckoning, a moment of despair at the same time, and I just really do hope that those who have lost all credibility amongst those that they claim to serve as leaders finally have some decency in them and are going to say that regardless of any cost to ourselves or our vested interest, we're just going to get things done now. We're actually going to do things better in this country and put it on a real sovereign and dignified footing.
Martin, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was Martin Chulov. You can follow the reporting he and Bethan McKernan are doing on the story at theguardian.com. My thanks to them both. This episode was produced by Joshua Kelly, me, Mythili Rao, and Serena Barker-Singh. Sound designed by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.